Welcome to the I-117 podcast, everyone. I'm your host, Ross Weingartner. This is the podcast to jump into current events involving social issues, equality, justice, and faith. Now, we're into May. It's almost been 2 months since many of the major shutdowns responding to COVID-19 began. Our lives have been uprooted since that time. They've been changed. We've had to adapt to new schedules, new habits, and we now have a new way of viewing our world. I think back when my students and I were first discussing the lockdowns in China, this would have been back in January, and it seemed like something totally impossible for those of us in the United States to ever experience. And yet, here we are. This past week, the conversation has started to turn toward relaxing restrictions in a safe and responsible way. Governors from many states are taking the first steps to move toward the next phase of our country's experience of this pandemic. Medical and scientific evidence demonstrate that this next phase will most certainly not look like what we had back before the lockdown. We're not looking at, you know, mass gatherings, full restaurants, concerts, packed midnight releases of summer blockbuster movies. Many jobs won't be the same. Our responsibilities will be altered to maintain social distancing or proper cleaning processes. And even more, people won't have jobs to immediately return to. With eyes starting to turn to the future, I'm hoping that our communities at every level, local, state, federal, start to see some of the ways that this virus has revealed the deep wrongs or oversights in the way our society currently functions. Just the other day, I was taking my time to read through the newspapers, trying to get a handle on what was happening throughout our world, try to see what the concerns of the day were. And what I found were several stories from several of the biggest newspapers in America, the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today. And they all had the same central message. Each newspaper had an article, or even several articles, talking about the experiences of people during this pandemic and how those experiences varied depending on people's situation in society or people's race. The first that I'd like to look at more closely is an article that I found in the New York Times. This article examines how the homeless in the city are dealing with the virus, specifically in regard to the nightly shutdowns of subways for cleaning. Now, New York City is going to have to start shutting down the subways regularly to clean them to help protect people against COVID-19 who are going to use public transportation. One of the issues that has arisen, however, is that a number of homeless people try to get whatever sleep they can on the subway. It's essentially their shelter. It's a place that is seen as relatively safe from both outdoor conditions and from other people. And this is especially true now when some look at homeless shelters as a possible danger due to the spread of the virus and the close proximity in which people live. Several of the people, the homeless people mentioned in the article, stated that this was their major fear. They didn't want to turn to a shelter where they'd be forced to live in close proximity with a number of people and risking getting the virus. Now, of course, the city officials are looking at the task of quickly cleaning these cars every night to try to provide for the safety of the daily commuters, those that rely on public transportation to get from one place to another. The city is trying to rent hotel rooms that are now empty due to a drop in tourism to provide for the homeless. But as the Urban Justice Center points out, more housing is necessary. There's not enough at the moment. And all this just demonstrates one of the struggles of the homeless and some of the issues with homeless shelters. This article demonstrates that there's a feeling, a lack of trust, or a feeling of risk, a lack of safety that some people have when viewing homeless shelters. One woman interviewed in the article said that she didn't want to go to the shelter for fear of contracting the virus, but also because she had previously been sexually assaulted at a shelter. For her, living in a subway car for years was much safer. It was a much preferable choice. The movement to put people into empty hotel rooms where they're able to have private bathrooms, adequate privacy, and security is wonderful. It addresses the fundamental lack of these things in crowded and underfunded shelters that exist throughout America, not just New York City. But we can all see that this solution is only temporary. When travel, business, tourism resumes, what's going to happen with these rooms? It's likely that they will no longer be excess, and there will be demand for them. So what then? What happens to the homeless that are currently being sheltered there? Are they asked to return to shelters, the streets? And again, as this article points out, there are homeless that do feel that the shelters are unsafe. Now, I actually read a similar article, and I can't remember if I talked about it here on the podcast or not, a few weeks ago about DC, where there were a group of homeless, and I believe they were living under an overpass, and they were forced to move by the local authorities. And they, quite frankly, said that they did not feel safe going to a homeless shelter. We all need to take a good, hard look at this issue. We've had 30 million people file for unemployment in the U.S. since mid-March. And we've talked before on this podcast many times about the number of people who are hanging on by a thread in our society. They were unable to afford consistent, regular food. They're not able to have a savings to help them get through unexpected costs or unexpected drop in income. It's very unlikely that all 30 million of these people will quickly find new employment as we continue working through this time. And so how many of those people will find or reach the point where they're no longer able to pay the bills to fill the gap? And when that happens, how many more does this add to the number of homeless in our country? And how is our country, how are our communities going to share the burden with these people? These people who are our friends, our families, our neighbors. Turning our backs, that's not an option. Like we said last week, we're not given the choice. We're not given the ability to turn away from our fellow people. We can't decide that they simply do not deserve our goodwill. It's hard. It's scary to confront this issue. It's scary to think about the ease with which good people, responsible, hardworking, loving, and loved people can end up in a situation where they don't have a home. It's much easier to turn a blind eye or not examine it too closely so we can view the situation through a haze of lies, bias, self-adulation. But our calling is not to take the easy path. That wasn't the way of Jesus, and it's not the way of Christianity. We have to examine the world with clear eyes. Another way that our worldviews, our views on America may be shifted, has been through the disproportionate effect that the virus has had on some communities. Both the New York Times and USA Today had articles identifying the disparity over the past few days. USA Today did an analysis of 3,200 zip codes across the country. They looked at COVID-19 case reports as well as demographic data on race, income, and housing. The result showed a clear correlation between race and income in the spread of COVID-19. The poorest neighborhoods had an infection rate twice as high as the wealthiest. Zip codes in which the majority of people were minorities had infection rates five times higher than those that had less than a 10% non-white population. Think about those numbers. What do they say about America when there can be such disparity depending on where you live or what type of background you come from? The article specifically looks at an area of Chicago with two bordering zip codes. One has a household income of around $101,000 and is 60% white. The other has an average household income of around $41,000, with 78% of the population being non-white. Currently, the virus infection rate of the lower income zip code is four times as high as its wealthier neighbor. Interviews in the article with people living in these communities demonstrates the difference in the way in which the virus has affected them. For the wealthier area, a number of people are outside, they're walking dogs, they're jogging, they're picking up takeout at restaurants. The reporter talks to a woman that says she doesn't know anybody who's had COVID. But just down that same street, there are people in the other zip code who are experiencing not only the fear of the virus, but the economic fallout. A local pastor that the reporter talks to talks about losing members of his church family. Another man who runs a food program has noticed a huge uptick in families in need. And the article states that this isn't unique to just this area of the country. It's not unique to just Chicago. Through their studies, they found similar incidents in places like Detroit. New York Times looked at this in a very similar manner. Their article specifically examined New Orleans and how COVID-19 has disproportionately decimated a Black community. The article went through the personal stories of those affected, the lives lost, the overwhelming grief shouldered by this community. And the article includes the shocking facts and statistics such as Black Americans have a life expectancy that is 3.5 years shorter than white Americans. And this is before the impact of COVID. These studies go on to show hospital care to Black patients of all socioeconomic levels lags behind the care of white patients at the same levels. And again, this article shows that this isn't just happening in New Orleans, but it's happening in Chicago, Mississippi, New York, Milwaukee. COVID-19 is showing us the flaws in our country's healthcare, the flaws in our country's social services. And it's making it so that we can't overlook these issues, these problems, these injustices. And we have to ask ourselves if we're okay with this. And I'm talking about serious reflection, because these issues, homelessness, hunger, healthcare, they can't be solved with the flip of a switch. There are no easy solutions. So reflect on this. Do we want to allow this disparity, this injustice to continue, even after COVID-19 is over and we start to return to some form of normalcy? This disparity is allowing kids, families, people with full lives and love, it's allowing them to suffer. So can we afford to ignore these issues? I imagine a number of people want to reply with a no but. And I want to stop right there. I want to hold off on that but for a moment. I've mentioned before the book Bread of the Resistance, a series of devotionals by Donna Barber. This devotional is both direct and supportive as it addresses the challenges of following the teachings of Jesus and implementing them in a culture that often views those teachings as radical, as out of line. She spends one section of the devotional talking about the idea of equity and how that is what we should be striving for in our society. Barber points out that equality implies everyone gets the same for everything. But that's a flawed system because it doesn't help bridge gaps. It doesn't help address the specific needs of people. So let's look at an example of this concept of equity, just to make it clear. We're now in May, and in a normal year, we'd be in the thick of baseball season. Kids as young as 4 or 5 getting ready, playing t-ball. Older kids playing Little League. You got your school teams, Legion ball, etc., etc. Now think about the coach of a Little League team. Coach has one player who's gifted athletically, spent hours practicing in his free time. And this kid has the potential to be a local star. There's another kid on that same team who's playing baseball for the first time. And he doesn't really know how to swing the bat. His throws are off target. And he seems like he might be afraid of the ball. But the coach knows that in order for the team to have a winning year, he needs both players to succeed. So what does he do? Obviously, both kids need different things. They need different instruction, different coaching. The kid who's less skilled, less practiced, is going to need more individual instruction in the basics to help him get up to speed, to help him develop the talents, the skills that are necessary to succeed. But the goal is eventually he will be contributing, he will be able to find success after all that work. And for the other kid, those basic drills aren't going to work. For that other kid, the coach is going to start taking on some more advanced drills, some more advanced teaching to match his level that will also help him progress. But you can see if the coach decides to treat each kid the same way, one of them is going to be missing out. You can even take those same two kids and change the topic, get away from baseball. And you can talk about playing the guitar, for instance. And maybe the kid who's a baseball star, he wants to learn how to play guitar because he thinks the guys that are up front in bands are pretty cool and he wants to be like them. Whereas the kid who struggles with baseball or is just getting started with baseball, he's mastered the guitar. He's playing guitar, he's playing bass, he's playing piano. Again, you can see that a teacher, a coach, is going to have to take different steps in providing for these kids and letting them become successful, helping them become successful. So let's take this back to the issues we've been discussing today. Homelessness, disparity in healthcare, all of it. I believe most people would immediately agree that these are terrible issues that need to be addressed. Even those who are privileged enough to not have to face them firsthand. But the real challenge, the place where this does get complicated, where we start to hear those buts, is when those who are privileged are asked to give up something that they want or something that they deem important in their world. Barber writes that even when the privileged consciously and publicly agrees with the redistribution of resources or position, he will often continuously, though perhaps unconsciously, look for opportunities to either reduce these adjustments or increase the requirements to receive them. And we see this. There's no denying that this happens. We know that people hold this belief. People often want to minimize their own liability or contribution to social programs. Think about taxes. Or people want to create further barriers to access to these social programs. I appreciate that Barber adds that this may happen unconsciously, because I think it's important for us all to reflect on our own stances and determine if those stances have been shaped by an unconscious desire, an unconscious thought. There are times where we may think that creating limits on social programs is the right thing to do. We might tell ourselves that we don't want people taking advantage of the system. Maybe we believe that if we give too much, we're not creating an incentive to work. If we're privileged enough to not have to rely on these programs, it's easy for our worldviews to be shaped by biases and misinformation. Because, of course, when we actually look at the evidence, evidence from economists and anecdotal evidence, we see that people rely on these programs to help them stay afloat during tough times. And there's evidence to point out that, no, these programs don't make people lazy or not provide them an incentive to work. That's just not true. But it's something that's so easy to tell yourself whenever you're not part of that group, when you see yourself as having this privilege. Now, Barber points out that not only was Jesus the Son of God, but he was born as a Jewish man. And in that time period, this would have given him some amount of privilege in his community at the time. But Jesus doesn't allow that to stop him or make him hesitate in going to the people that need him the most. It doesn't matter their background, their culture, their social standing. He doesn't set a certain bar that these people must meet in order to qualify for his aid. He goes to them all in a spirit of brotherhood and community. And he is with them. He's not pandering. He's not patronizing. He is genuine. He cares for them. He cares for their well-being. Jesus shows us that each member of our community is deserving of love, dignity, and belonging. Now, earlier, I asked the question, are you okay with homelessness or the current options for many of the homeless in our country? And I asked if you were comfortable in the disparity in healthcare between racial and socioeconomic levels. I mentioned that the answer for many people in our country, in our world, was probably no, and then there'd be that but. But let's reconsider that. If Jesus was faced with these challenges coming from a privileged position, would he find that whatever followed but to be enough? Would he be okay with the excuses that we hear from ourselves or from our leaders on issues like this? Remember, in addressing these huge, dire problems, we have to use whatever tools we have. We're talking about people's lives. We're talking about generations of lives. We have to use our tools to help these people, whether these tools are our direct resources, money, goods, donations, whatever. Whether it's our time, whether it's our work, our activism, whether it's raising awareness of the problem, building connections with people who commit to working towards solutions, reaching people that are in even more privileged positions than ourselves, who have even greater resources or greater power to make a difference. People coming together to work toward a solution is how we get to these solutions. As we talked about last week, solving problems like hunger takes a large, large group of people. It takes work from every level of a community. We're talking local, state, federal. And COVID-19 has shown us that radical change in the face of catastrophe is possible. Think about it. We've shut down an entire nation to fight against this threat. Some would have called that incredibly radical, impossible, just a few months ago. They would have spouted hundreds of reasons for why that couldn't happen in America. But here we are. Because enough people recognize the danger, they recognize the need for temporary sacrifice to help our nation as a whole, to save countless lives. What can we do if we take that same energy, that same fervency in fighting against homelessness or hunger, or repairing our healthcare system to make it equitable? For now, as we are looking into the future of this nation, let's forget the but and focus what is possible. And then let's do the work to make it so, all of us, because it's going to take all of us and more. Because that's what Jesus would have us do. So I'm going to leave it on that note for this week. I think that this is this gives us a lot to think about for the future. The reopening of this country, it's gonna take a long time. It's gonna be a long time before we're back to some type of normal. It's not gonna be just in the coming weeks. But through that all, I hope that you're all aware of these issues. And we don't forget about COVID. We don't forget how we can help our healthcare workers or the people who are suffering during this time. But let's also start to think about what the future of our country, of our communities is going to look like. So thank you. Thank you very much for listening to the podcast. I appreciate all the support. I appreciate the kind words. If you want to get a hold of me, you can always reach out. Go to the Facebook page, facebook.com/I117. I'd love to hear from you, hear your thoughts, your ideas, just chat. As always, if you like the podcast, feel free to share it. I encourage you to share it. And then you're also welcome to leave a nice rating on whatever podcast app you use. If you're using iTunes or Apple Podcasts, whatever it is nowadays, if you could leave a 5-star review, that'd really help with discoverability, spreading this, getting this into this message to other people. So thanks again for listening, and I hope you all have a wonderful week.